welcome back to Count Dracula. I think we're only a third of the way through, which is a bit of a downer for everyone, really, myself included. And we struggle on, we push on. At least it's not raining outside, which is very unusual now that a monsoon season has evolved so recently in Lincolnshire, with help from the US Air Force, I'm sure. And joking, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, obviously. And where are we? Why don't we push on into... can't quite remember where we are. Does anyone know? Does anyone want to contribute? I think we ended up... do leave comments, by the way. It's a lonely ship we all sail on here. And, I know I don't have a multitude of listeners, but anyone who wants to leave a comment or hit that heart, as we say in the world of myocarditis and cardiology, hit that heart, please do so. So we left off with Van Helsing, who has a similar accent to Count Dracula, which will be confusing as the novel progresses, but... We don't want to solve every dramatic problem at the moment. We'll wait till there's a car crash later on. So he says, "If you leave her and harm befall, you shall not sleep easy hereafter." And we move on to Dr. Seward's diary, continued. If you remember, he's got a little bit of an estuary twang. We assume he got a scholarship to Basingstoke Technical College, and possibly with the aid of his John Bull printing set, he was able to forge a medical certificate from Guy's or Bart's or somewhere like that, and therefore has managed to get a job on the lower echelons of healthcare, of course, mental healthcare, and he's even got his own asylum, which must be nice. And here he is. Dr. Seward's diary continued, 8th of September. So it's lovely. It's autumnal. "I sat up all night with Lucy. The opiate worked itself off towards dusk, and she waked naturally. She looked a different being from what she had been before the operation. Her spirits even were good, and she was full of a happy vivacity, but I could see evidences of the absolute prostration which she had undergone. When I told Mrs. Westenra that Dr. Van Helsing had directed that I should sit up with her, she almost pooh-poohed the idea, pointing out her daughter's renewed strength and excellent spirits. I was firm, however, and made preparations for my long vigil. When her maid had prepared her for the night..." Wouldn't it be great if everyone had a maid to prepare one for the night? Those days are sadly gone, and... I think it's probably right. Unless, of course, someone lower down the old pyramid prepared the maid for the night, and then it went on down and down until... the undergardener was being prepared for the night by a sort of well-trained hound of some description. Maybe that's how it all does work, that we all get the maid we deserve, according to the pecking order anyway. I mean, let's not dwell on that odd thought. "When a maid had prepared for the night, I came in, having in the meantime had supper. Yes, a pot noodle, a small mini pork pie with Branston pickle strangely injected into its upper pastry, and took a seat by the bedside. She did not in any way make objection, but looked at me gratefully whenever I caught her eye. After a long spell, she seemed sinking off to sleep, but with an effort seemed to pull herself together and shook it off. It was apparent that she did not want to sleep, so I tackled the subject at once. You do not want to sleep. See how I went straight for that thought I had in my head and repeated it almost exactly. You do not want to sleep. No, I'm afraid. Afraid to go to sleep? Why so? It's the boon we all crave for. Sounds like an advertisement for Fry's Chocolate Delight, doesn't it? Turkish Delight. It's the boon we all crave for. Fry's Chocolate Delight. Tuppence. From your local newsagents. Got a cup of coffee on the go here. I'll just pop that down. And let's, Ah, not if you were like me. If sleep was to you a presage of horror. A presage of horror? What on earth do you mean? I don't know. Oh, I don't know. And that it is, that is what is so terrible. All this weakness comes to me in sleep until I dread the very thought. But, my dear girl, you may sleep tonight. I'm here watching you. And I can promise that nothing will happen. Ah, I can trust you, she said. I can promise you that nothing will happen. How many times have those words been uttered in the course of history? I seized the opportunity and said, I promise that if I see any evidence of bad dreams, I will wake you at once. Unless they're my bad dreams, of course, in which case I'll tragically be asleep. You will? Oh, will you really? How good you are to me. Then I will sleep. And almost at the word, she gave a deep sigh of relief and sank back. Asleep. Ah, Lavazza. It's a nice, tasty coffee, isn't it? This isn't an advertising break or a moment. This is a word from our sponsors, Lavazza, the coffee company. I mean, we buy it in big bags and grind it off ourselves. That's not one of Dr. Seward's statements. That's one of my statements. And there we have it. I've just had a nice breakfast, so I'm all right. Although it's quite late. It's 11:37, according to my trusty Kindle, the one I can actually pick up. The other one's so big. So big, you've got to grin to get it in, as they used to say regarding that toothsome comestible, the wagon wheel, which has diminished considerably over time, its diameter. Always made me laugh. It's so big, you've got to grin to get it in. There was a smile on her face. No, there wasn't, not quite yet. All night long I watched by her. She never stirred, but slept on and on in a deep, tranquil, life-giving, health-giving sleep. Her lips were slightly parted and her breast rose and fell with the regularity of a pendulum. There was a smile on her face, and it was evident that no bad dreams had come to disturb her peace of mind. In the early morning, her maid came, good, to get her up and ease the cereal out of the variety pack. And I left her in her care and took myself back home. It was an interesting phrase. I took myself back home, for I was anxious about many things. I sent a short wire to Van Helsing and to Arthur, telling them of the excellent result of the operation. My own work, with its manifold arrears, took me all day to clear off and move the microphone now. It was dark when I was able to inquire about my zoophagus patient. The report was good. He had been quite quiet for the past day and night. A telegram came from Van Helsing at Amsterdam whilst I was at dinner, suggesting that I should be at Hillingham tonight. Assuming Hillingham some kind of fictional place name. It's not Hillingdon. As it might be well to be at hand. As it might be well to be at hand. As it might be well to be at hand. And stating that he was leaving by the night mail, crossing the border, and would join me early in the morning. 9th of September. See, I reverted to my narrative voice, which is my voice, and I keep forgetting I'm doing Seward's diary. It's very annoying. Not terribly professional, is it? But then, this is not a crucible of professionalism. This is a crucible of amateur Fright Night. I was pretty tired and worn out when I got to Hillingham. For 2 nights I had hardly had a wink of sleep, and my brain, it's very clicky this, I think it's the, could it be the dairy in my Lavazza? I don't know. And my brain was beginning to feel that numbness which marks cerebral exhaustion. Lucy was up and in cheerful spirits. When she shook hands with me, she looked sharply in my face and said, "No sitting up tonight for you. No sitting up tonight for you." Okay. I was just mucking around there with some knobs on my old Yamaha. I regret it now. It's broken my train of thought. Very clicky voice. I'll try and de-click it later. It should take out the more egregious castanet sounds from my chops. For 2 nights I had hardly had a wink of sleep, and my brain was beginning to feel that numbness, which marks cerebral exhaustion. Lucy was up and in cheerful spirits. Déjà vu. When she shook hands with me, she looked sharply in my face and said, "No sitting up tonight for you. You are worn out. I am quite well again. Indeed I am. And if there is to be any sitting up, it is I who will sit up with you." I would not argue that point, but went and had my supper. Another mini pork pie, it was from a pack of six, with the Branston or some other ploughman's type pickle injected under the pastry lid. Lucy came with me, and enlivened by her charming presence, I made an excellent meal and finished off with a fondant fancy from the house of Mr. Kipling, and had a couple of glasses of the more than excellent port. Coburn's? Yes, it does a little. Followed by some cranberry juice. Then Lucy took me upstairs and showed me a room next her own, where a cosy fire was burning. "Now," she said, "you must stay here. I shall leave this door open, and my door too. You can lie on the sofa, for I know that nothing would induce any of you doctors to go to bed whilst there is a patient above the horizon. If I want anything, I shall call out, and you can come to me at once." Thanks for the privilege. I could not but acquiesce, for I was dog-tired, and could not have sat up had I tried. So, on renewing her promise to call me, if she should want anything, I lay on the sofa and forgot all about everything. Good trick if you could do it. Well done. Lucy Westenra's diary. 9th of September. I feel so happy tonight. I've been so miserably weak that to be able to think and move about is like feeling sunshine after a long spell of east wind out of a steel sky. Very good, she's got her poetry back. Somehow Arthur feels very, very close to me. I seem to feel his presence warm about me. And maybe that was the vindaloo, love. I suppose it is that sickness and weakness are selfish things, and turn our inner eyes and sympathy on ourselves, while health and strength give love rein, and in thought and feeling he can wander where he wills. I know where my thoughts are. If only Arthur knew, my dear, your ears must tingle as you sleep, as mine do waking. Oh, the blissful rest of last night, how I slept, with that dear good Dr. Seward watching me. And tonight I shall not fear to sleep, since he is close at hand and within call. Thank everybody for being so good to me. Thank God. Good night, Arthur. All right, let's see if we can recapture Dr. Seward's costermonger tones. 10th of September, Dr. Seward's diary. I was conscious of the professor's hand on my head. Oh, yes. And started awake all in a second. That is one of the things that we learn in an asylum at any rate. And how is our patient? Well, when I left her, or rather when she left me, I answered. Well, when I left her, or rather when she left me, I answered. Come, let us see, he said. and together we went into the room. The blind was down, and I went over it to raise it gently while Van Helsing stepped in with his soft cat-like tread over to the bed. As I raised the blind and the morning sunlight flooded the room, I heard the professor's low hiss of inspiration, and knowing its rarity, a deadly fear shot through my heart. As I passed over, he moved back, and his exclamation of horror, "Gott in Himmel!" needed no enforcement from his agonized face. He raised his hand and pointed to the bed, and his iron face was drawn and ashen white. I felt my knees begin to tremble. There on the bed, seemingly in a swoon, lay poor Lucy, more horribly white and wan-looking than ever. Even the lips were white, and the gums seemed to have shrunken back from the teeth, as we sometimes see in a corpse after a prolonged illness. Thanks for that. Van Helsing raised his foot to stamp in anger, but the instinct of his life and all the long years of habit stood to him, and he put it down again softly. "Quick," he said, "bring the brandy." I flew to the dining room and returned with the decanter. Unfortunately, it was a decanter full of Midori, the disgusting melon liqueur. He wetted the poor white lips with it, and together we rubbed palm and wrist and heart. He felt her heart, and after a few moments of agonizing suspense, said, "It is not too late. It beats, though but feebly. All our work is undone. We must begin again. There is no young Arthur here now. I have to call on you yourself this time, friend John." "Hey, friend John." As he spoke, he was dipping into his bag and producing the instruments of transfusion. I had taken off my coat and rolled up my shirt sleeve. There was no possibility of an opiate just at present, and no need of one, and so, without a moment's delay, we began the operation. After a time, it did not seem a short time either, for the draining away of one's blood, no matter how willingly it be given, is a terrible feeling. Van Helsing held up a warning finger. "Do not stir," he said. "But I fear that with growing strength she may wake, and that would make danger, oh, so much danger. But I shall precaution take. I shall give hypodermic injection of morphia." He proceeded then, swiftly and deftly, to carry out his intent. Nothing like a swift and deft doctor, is there? The effect on Lucy was not bad, for the faint seemed to merge subtly into the narcotic sleep. It was with a feeling of personal pride that I could eat another one of those pepperamis. It was with a feeling of personal pride that I could see a faint tinge of colour steal back into the pallid cheeks and lips. Yes, that's the blood donor effect, a warm feeling of having done something quite good. No man knows till he experiences it what it is to feel his own lifeblood drawn away into the veins of the woman he loves. It's very true, it's a rare experience. The professor watched me critically. "This will do," he said. "Already?" I remonstrated. "You took a great deal more from art." To which he smiled, a sad sort of smile, as he replied, "He is her lover, her fiancé. You have work, much work to do for her and for others, and the present will suffice." When we stopped the operation, he attended to Lucy, whilst I applied digital pressure to my own incision. Good idea. I laid down while I waited his leisure to attend to me, for I felt faint and a little sick. By and by he bound up my wound and sent me downstairs to get a glass of Midori for myself. As I was leaving the room, he came after me and half whispered, "Mind, nothing must be said of this. If our young lover should turn up unexpected as before, no word to him. It would at once frighten him and enjealous him too." There must be none. So, when I came back, he looked at me carefully as I was cramming down a packet of Hobnobs milk chocolate, and then said, "You are not much the worse. Go into the room and lie on your sofa and rest a while. Then have much breakfast. Put those Hobnobs down, they're very bad for you. And come here to me." I followed out his orders a full English with black pudding, which I thought would be restorative in its own right, and it was, for I knew how right and wise they were. I'd done my part, and now my next duty was to keep up my strength on that, those Lincolnshire sausages, and the scrambled eggs with Devon cream. I felt very weak, and in the weakness lost something of the amazement at what had occurred. I fell asleep on the sofa, however, watching the 3:10 from Chepstow, wondering over and over again how Lucy had made such a retrograde movement, and how she could have been drained of so much blood with no sign anywhere to show for it. I think I must have continued my wonder in my dreams, for sleeping and waking, my thoughts always came back to the little punctures in her rally chopper. I mean in her throat, and the ragged, exhausted appearance of their edges, tiny though they were. Lucy slept well into the day. Lucy slept well into the day, and when she woke, she was fairly well and strong, though not nearly so much so as the day before. When Van Helsing had seen her, he went out for a walk, leaving me in charge, with strict injunctions that I was not to leave her for a moment. I could hear his voice in the hall, asking the way to the nearest telegraph office. Lucy chatted with me freely and seemed quite unconscious that anything had happened. I tried to keep her amused and interested. When her mother came up to see her, she did not seem to notice any change whatever, but said to me gratefully, "We owe you so much, Dr. Seward, for all you have done, but you really must now take care not to overwork yourself. You are looking pale yourself. You want a wife to nurse and look after you a bit. That you do." As she spoke, Lucy turned crimson, though it was only momentarily. Momentarily, I think. For her poor wasted veins could not stand for long, an unwonted drain to the head. An unwonted drain to the head. It sounds like a sort of Chelsea football hooligan. Yeah, I gave him an unwonted drain to the head. The reaction came in excessive pallor as she turned imploring eyes on me. I smiled and nodded and laid my finger on my lips, where I discovered quite a lot of Hobnob chocolate. With a sigh, she sank back amid her pillows. Van Helsing returned in a couple of hours and presently said to me, "Now you go home and eat much and drink enough. No pork pies with the Branston pickle. I know what you like. And no Midori. I like the Midori for myself." "Well, I don't want the Midori." "Well, I'm only saying, maybe you could have some Bristol cream or Enver cream or a Cyprus sherry. It's cheap. Make yourself strong. I stay here tonight and I shall sit up with little miss myself." Little miss myself. "You and I must watch the case, and we must have none other to know. I have grave reasons. No, do not ask me. Think what you will. Do not fear to think even the most not improbable. Good night." I didn't know what the geezer was talking about. In the hall, two of the maids came to me and asked if they, or either of them, might not sit up with Miss Lucy. They implored me to let them, and when I said it was Dr. Van Helsing's wish that either he or I should sit up, they asked me quite piteously to intercede with the foreign gentleman. I was much touched by their kindness. Perhaps it's because I'm weak at present, and perhaps because it was on Lucy's account that their devotion was manifested. For over and over again have I seen similar instances of woman's kindness. Well, it was probably more the fact that they stood to lose their jobs if the woman they undress every morning and, no, dress every morning and undress every night was going to slip away, they'd probably lose their jobs. Because I'm sure old Mrs. Westenra can get a kit off herself. Possibly. For over and over again Have I seen similar instances of woman's kindness? We all have. I got back here in time for a late dinner. I'm afraid I did finish off the pack of six mini pork pies, went to my rounds, all well, and set this down while waiting for sleep. It is coming. 11th of September. This afternoon I went over to Hillingham, found Van Helsing in excellent spirits and Lucy much better. Shortly after I had arrived, a big parcel from abroad came for the Professor. He opened it with much impressment, assumed, of course, and showed a great bundle of white flowers. "These are for you, Miss Lucy," he said. "For me? Oh, Dr. Van Helsing." "Yes, my dear, but not for you to play with. These are medicines." Here Lucy made a wry face. "Nay, but they are not to take in a decoration or in nauseous form. Nay, but they are not to take in a decoration." Okay, misread. Alert. "Nay, but they are not to take in a decoction or in nauseous form. So you need not snub that so charming nose, or I shall point out to my friend Arthur what woes he may have to endure in seeing so much beauty that he so loves, so much distort. Ha ha, my pretty miss. That bring the so nice nose all straight again. This is medicinal. But you do not know how? I put him in your window. I make pretty wreath and hang him round your neck, so you sleep well. Oh, yes. They, like the lotus flower, make your trouble forgotten. It smell so like the waters of Lethe, and of that fountain of youth that the conquistadores sought for in the Floridas, and find him all too late." Whilst he was speaking, Lucy had been examining the flowers and smelling them. Now she threw them down, saying with half laughter and half disgust, "Oh, Professor, I believe you are only putting up a joke on me. Why, these flowers are only common garlic." To my surprise, Van Helsing rose up and said with all his sternness, his iron jaw set and his bushy eyebrows meeting, "No trifling with me, I never jest. There is grim purpose in what I do, and I warn you that you do not thwart me. Take care for the sake of others, if not for your own." Then seeing poor Lucy scared, as she might well be, he went on more gently, "Oh, little miss, my dear, do not fear me. I only do for your good, but there is much virtue to you in those so common flowers. See, I place them myself in your room. I make myself the wreath that you are to wear. But hush! No telling to others that make so inquisitive questions. We must obey, and silence is a part of obedience, and obedience is to bring you strong and well into loving arms that wait for you. Now sit still a while. Come with me, friend John, and you shall help me deck the room with my garlic, which is all the war from Harlem, or maybe which is all the way from Harlem, where my friend Vanderpool raises herb in his glass houses all the year. I had to telegraph yesterday, or they would not have been here." Well, we went into the room, taking the flowers with us. The Professor's actions were certainly odd and not to be found in any pharmacopoeia that I ever heard of. No, indeed. First, he fastened up the windows and latched them securely. Next, taking a handful of the flowers, he rubbed them all over the sashes, as though to ensure that every whiff of air that might get in would be laden with the garlic smell. Then, with the wisp, he rubbed all over the jamb of the door, above, below, and at each side, and round the fireplace in the same way. It all seemed grotesque to me, and presently I said, "Well, Professor, I know you always have a reason for what you do, but this certainly puzzles me. It's well we have no sceptic here, or he would say that you were working some spell to keep out an evil spirit." "Perhaps I am," he answered quietly as he began to make the wreath, which Lucy was to wear round her neck. When we waited, whilst Lucy made her toilet for the night, and when she was in bed, he came and himself fixed the wreath of garlic round her neck. The last words he said to her were, "Take care you do not disturb it, and even if the room feel close, do not tonight open the window or the door." "I promise," said Lucy, "and thank you both 1,000 times for all your kindness to me. Oh, what have I done to be blessed with such friends?" As we left the house in my fly, which was waiting, Van Helsing said, "Tonight I can sleep in peace, and sleep I want. 2 nights of travel, much reading in the day between, and much anxiety on the day to follow, and a night to sit up without a wink. Tomorrow in the morning early you called for me, and we come together to see our pretty miss, so much more strong for my spell which I have worked." Ho-ho! Strange ho-ho at the end there. He seemed so confident that I, remembering my own confidence 2 nights before, and with the baneful result, felt awe and vague terror. It must have been my weakness that made me hesitate to tell it to my friend, but I felt it all the more, like unshed tears. Good line, Bram, to finish on, a very good line. It felt like unshed tears. Well, and that pretty much brings us to the close of that episode, and indeed it moves us on, ineluctably, if that's a word, to Chapter 11. And we'll be getting into the meat of that, the neck meat, probably. We're getting into the centre of that highly dramatic chapter, I imagine, very soon. It only remains for me to say what a miserable August we're getting. But remember, things can only get better if you get yourself an Airbnb and spend 3 months in Spain, overwintering, as we should all do, like they used to in the past, like Chopin went to live due to his enfeebled state with old George Sand on the island of, can't remember, but it was somewhere in the Mediterranean, and, probably did him the world of good, and we should all bugger off to some warmer climes over the winter, and, because if the summer's like this, we've just got to get away, and Guinea-Bissau by the beach might be lovely. Thanks for listening. Leave a comment, just to prove there's someone out there. And otherwise, if you want to listen to my much more professionally produced Sherlock Holmes stories, you can find them on YouTube somewhere. The search engine is your friend. And you could enjoy The Hound of the Baskervilles as a nice contrast to the bats of the Belfry. See ya.